You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
Ready for a new and exciting career challenge? At DHL Supply Chain, you're part of a team committed to creating innovative solutions for some of the biggest brands in the world. We're recognized as a best place to work, where people are valued, supported, and respected. DHL Supply Chain is hiring for a wide range of salaried operational and functional roles. Previous experience in logistics is welcome, but not required. All opportunities, no boundaries. DHL Supply Chain. Apply today at joindhl.com.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Stansberry Radio Network.
So, Amanda Palmer, author of The Art of Asking, musician, performer, speaker, author. Thanks for coming on to my podcast.
No problem. Hi.
Amanda, when I was reading The Art of Asking, I got actually depressed at first because I'm supposed to write a book called The Power of Ask. And I actually said, even to my publisher, I can't write this anymore. Amanda Palmer has already written the book because your book is excellent.
You may have to change the title. I'm sure, you know, I felt, if it makes you feel any better, I felt exactly the same way. Right when I started busting into my book and writing the first few chapters, I picked up Daring Greatly by Brené Brown. And I was like, fuck, she already wrote my book. This is useless. Even though she was writing it from an academic perspective, like we were covering a lot of the same ground. And then I just gave myself cosmic permission. You know, even though I was saying a lot of the same things, I decided to embrace it as a matter of zeitgeist.
Well, a couple points there. I think her book, which I read also, is an excellent book. I think it does rely a lot on academic research as well as her personal experience. Whereas I view your book almost as, it's almost like a weird sort of sequel to Just Kids by Patti Smith, because it's not only about the art of asking, but it's also about art and how does one become an artist, and when does one give themselves permission to say they're an artist? And what do you see as the relationship between asking and being an artist?
Well, God, I mean, there's just collisions all over the place. And I mean, that's the thing. I feel like we are fundamentally, as human beings, I feel like we're all artistic at a certain level. We're all creative. We all see connections. We all have the ability to manifest from scratch. You know, in other cultures, you know, our culture's pretty weird. In other cultures, everybody sings, everybody dances, everybody creates. And, you know, we've got a bizarre way of defining art to begin with. And one of the things that I think is so sad about our culture is that we make art and artists such a sort of, you know, special compartmentalized thing when actually it's not. And, you know, asking is fundamentally about connection. And so is art. I mean, when you boil everything down to its simplest component, little protons and neutrons. I mean, art is about people connecting with people at a really, really basic level. That's what art is.
And so
is asking. So, I mean, that's where the big Venn diagram overlap is, as far as I'm concerned.
You know, and part of it all, when you put a work of art out there, or when you ask, and it doesn't matter what you're asking for, I think both things share this element of vulnerability. Like, I'm afraid often to ask people a favor, for instance. And I think a lot of people are. Or many people are afraid to ask for a promotion. Or many people are afraid to ask, hey, look at or buy my art. And how does one overcome that vulnerability, do you think? What's an easy way, even though there might not be an easy way?
I wish there was an easy way. There's not an easy way. And that's the point. If there was an easy way, we'd all be happy and everybody would do it all the time and we would be living in a fantastic society with no fear and no pain. And the problem is, you know, the problem is always just fear. It always comes back to fear. Fear of rejection, fear of feeling more disconnected than before, fear, you know, that fear of failure that is associated with rejection. And again, like, both of those things show up in art and in asking. I mean, art requires asking, because you don't make art in a vacuum. You make art to share with others. And I've always thought, you know, any musician who's ever told me, nah, it's bullshit, I make art for myself, I don't actually make music for people to listen to, you know, I would go crazy if I didn't write songs, I just don't believe them. I believe that fundamentally down there, expression needs a target. It's never just you alone in your room with your brain, and your brain is your own audience. It can be close to that, and it can be just expression for God or just expression to get something out of your system. But 99.9% of the time, the expression is for something else. It just doesn't exist alone. And that brings us around to asking, because then you're asking the universe to regard what you've created, whether it's the people or whether it's God or whether it's the kids down the street, and then in, you know, comes rolling in the judgment.
Well, then also, you know, art often costs money to make. Like, if you wanted to spend your life creating art and not working in an office, you know, just kind of like at the basic level, you need money for it. And I think you were able to combine this asking with art with money so well in your Kickstarter project, which I should mention. You had at the time the biggest Kickstarter ever. You raised $1.2 million to do an album with almost 25,000 backers. That was incredible, and that's a huge ask of your audience.
Yeah.
And what?
Well, but funny enough, the ask wasn't huge. The ask was small. The result was huge. The ask was, give me a dollar, or give me 25, or if you're a huge fan, buy the $500 package. But I asked people to purchase at the level they could afford. And I still encourage artists to this day to make the barrier to entry as low as possible, to make sure that there is a $1 option to join the club.
So again, it's hard though, like after you raised that money, there was all sorts of what I'm going to call outrage porn on the internet. And it seems like, you know, it seems like you're subject to that quite a bit. Like, and you talk about that in the book, dealing with that. And I think anybody, you know, who puts themselves out there is going to have outrage porn come back, because that just, it gives people something to do. So I'm going to be mad at Amanda Palmer for a day. They don't feel it, but you do. Cause it, you know, there's all sorts of studies that show you could have 10 things that say Amanda Palmer's the best, and then one thing that says, oh, she sucks, and you're going to feel the one thing that's negative.
And the ratio is way higher than that. I could have 99 articles praising me and one tearing me down, and it can overpower your psyche for a day, for sure.
Yeah, and that's part of asking too, because you can ask and people say no. Now, you started kind of your, I don't want to call it career, but you when you were younger, you were a frozen bride in Harvard Square, and you would exchange for a dollar or two a flower. So you had a lot of experience being rejected, because I'm sure many people just passed you by and gave you nothing. But it still doesn't help with the asking later.
Well, you know, I think a lot of what I learned as a street performer was how to frame my environment. And instead of feeling like those, you know, 1,000 people a day who walked by me without engaging were rejecting me, I just didn't focus on them at all. And I didn't frame them as rejectors, and I didn't frame that as rejection. I just refocused my energy on, you know, the 1 in 100 person who was passing and engaging. That was my audience. I discussed this in my book. There's a great anecdote about Dita Von Teese, the burlesque star. And she tells the story of back in the day, you know, before she, you know, started making lingerie and perfumes and doing high-end burlesque. She was, like I was, a more run-of-the-mill stripper. And but she was, like I was, she was kind of an art freak. And while these other strippers in the club, you know, with their, like, their tans and their blonde hair and their neon bikinis would do their 3 songs and strip totally bare naked and get $51 bills from the dudes at the bar, Dita would, like, come out in vintage lingerie and strip down to her underwear, totally confusing everybody who was used to, like, the regular stripper routine, but there would be one guy in the crowd who would give her $50. And so, I really see that. I mean, it's like a classic sort of cult audience artist relationship. And I really felt that I brought that kind of attitude to the street, and I brought that kind of attitude to my band as well, because my band made really crazy, emotional, theatrical music. It was not, you know, it was not the pop music of the day. It did not sound like dance music. It did not sound like Lady Gaga or Katy Perry. It sounded like piano and drums music, you know, made by two really emotional musicians singing about, you know, pain, heartbreak, and transsexuality, and, you know, with mile-a-minute lyrics. And the people who loved that music really loved it. And the people who didn't get it and didn't have time for it, you know, I just couldn't be concerned with them. I had to pay attention to the audience that I actually captured.
So it seems like, and you describe this in your book, it almost seems like you're talking about 3 layers of people you can ask. There's the people who are just going to blindly walk by, and you don't care about them. Or, I mean, you care about them, but it's not so important whether they say yes or no to you. And then there's the people who are your, let's call them your weak ties. They're your fans, and they love your product, and you love them, and you could feel comfortable asking them, you know, in exchange for whatever, like on a Kickstarter project. But then there's the strong ties. Like you mentioned, you know, it was very hard for you to ask for money from your husband, for instance. And what do you think the difference is between these types of asks?
Well, I think some of it has to do with reciprocity and responsibility. You know, one of the things that I loved about being a street performer, and like in that, does this show up in your other relationships, Amanda? Like, yeah, it did. Like, I loved fleeting love affairs, you know, on the street and in my real life. I loved, you know, I loved the idea of flash intimacy and like hot, passionate love affairs without having to actually, you know, settle down to a committed relationship. And I ran my art business sort of the same way I ran my life, which is I sort of wanted like optimal payback for as little commitment as possible.
Hey, don't we all?
A lot of people will understand that when it comes to their relationships. And you know, and then there are times where you really have to dig your heels into a deeper relationship and say, okay, I'm going to have to compromise. I'm going to have to sacrifice. I'm going to have to pin myself to the wall a little bit, but in exchange, I am going to get safety, reliability, and, you know, and these are the choices that we make in our business relationships and in our love relationships. They really reflect each other. You know, I personally was never, ever, ever going to get married, and then, you know, fucking look at me now. I did it.
Yeah, it's impossible. Ultimately, it's impossible to predict the future on basically any aspect of our lives. So, you know, you fell in love, you got married, which you didn't expect to have happen. But even after you got married, you mentioned it was still hard to ask for money from your husband.
Yeah, it was. And I mean, I go into this in like painstaking detail in the book. You know, the ones who can hurt you, the ones who really have access to your heart and your pride and your weak spots, those are the people that we're the most vulnerable with. Those are the people it's hardest to ask. It's our partners and our parents and our children and the ones who can really, really hurt us because they're so close. And that's why there seems to be such a paradox sometimes where you've got people, you know, who are at the top of their game in their businesses, and they can ask their customers, they can ask their bosses, but they can't go home and ask their wife for more love or more attention. And they can't ask their friends for a helping hand because they're just afraid they're going to get burned in that arena because they're too vulnerable and they're too scared. And we all have different kinds of armor, and we wear it in different places, and we have different Achilles heels when it comes to where we're afraid to be rejected.
And so how do you...
You can't graft one onto the other. You know, it can sometimes be really confusing because we expect someone who's great at business asking to be great at emotional asking, and it just isn't always true.
And for you personally, like, how would you recommend someone break through that armor right now to ask the important questions? Let's give a specific example. Somebody's going broke and they need to ask a relative to borrow some money, for instance, but they're scared to death of feeling ashamed and they're scared to death of rejection and how it'll affect their relationship with their relation.
Accept the fear and be as transparent as possible. And I say, you know, I think the only way that you can do it is you lead with the truth. So if you're feeling this, you know, if you're feeling this giant shame and fear, that's what you lead with. You make the call and you say, you know, Uncle Chris, Aunt Betty, it's so hard for me to ask this, and my face is burning while I say it, and I'm filled with shame, and it's really scary, and I'm sorry for this huge preamble, but I need to ask for a loan. And there's something about the honesty and the transparency and the kind of grace and humility in saying, listen, this is my situation, and here is how I am feeling right now. And a huge part of it is also setting up and asking for things like that with the allowance that no is an acceptable answer. Because we have all of these subtle cues in language and in tone of voice where we can kind of say, and if you reject me, I will never talk to you again because I'll just be so humiliated, or I'll be so angry, or I'll be so resentful. And there's always a way you can package an ask like that with, and it's okay if you say no. It won't change our relationship. I needed to ask. I'm totally ready to accept no as an answer, but if it is possible, could you XYZ? And, so, and allowing people the space and the grace to say, you know, it's a tough time for us too, or God, I wish you'd asked 6 months ago, or could you come back in a couple of months because right now it's not a good time. Allowing the space on the other side is so important. That's a big one.
That's great advice. And now I want to take it one step further from that. Let's say the relationship between artists and fans. So often artists begin their career by essentially giving as much as possible for free. That's how you get known. That's how you get out there. You either write books or paint paintings or perform as much as possible for as little money as possible. And it just seems like a natural way that art happens. But then when you, at some point, you have to start either asking for money or making for money from what you do, because that's how people live. So how do artists get over the fear of asking their fans for money? Not just money, by the way. It could be favors. It could be anything. And you do this very well across the board.
Sure. I mean, a big part of it is that, we are living in this capitalist system of supply and demand. And supply and demand does extend into pretty much every sphere of art. So, you know, you learn these things by experimenting. And as soon as there is a demand, that's when you can charge for it. And you learn what you can charge for it by experimenting, by making mistakes, by overcharging, by undercharging, by pissing people off, by asking for too much, by asking for too little. And slowly you start to, you know, you start to find your groove and find the answer. And I still do this dance to this day. Every artist does. Because, you know, as long as you're an artist, people will always come and try to pay you too much or too little. And, you know, and your scruples need to be, you know, tightly screwed in place where, you know, you may be thinking you're looking at a gigantic payday, but it's going to come, you know, with a price tag to your reputation. Or you may be looking at really, really wanting to do someone a favor, but charging someone a kind of a nominal per diem or a fee or just an honorarium so that it feels like your work has some value. You know, I was talking to a lawyer or seeing a comment, I think, recently from a lawyer on a discussion thread about art and money who said, you know, they get asked to work all the time for free, especially by art groups and artists who just don't have the money to hire a lawyer to deal with the stuff that they need to deal with. And this is like a really, really good person who's really compassionate, who wants to help everybody. And she said, I have found that I have to charge something, even if it's just, you know, the minimum $100. Because when I work completely for free, I find that people don't cooperate as much. And she's had to, you know, she's worked for 10 years and she's just had to find that balance by toppling around and realizing that there are these mental barriers and, you know, these mental habits that we have when we think someone's just doing us a solid, you know, or when we've laid down money on the table. And studies have been done. I mean, the statistics are in. People will value things that they have paid for. To what extent do they need to pay for them? You know, it depends on the art. You know, is it an MP3? Is it a book? Is it a film? You know, is it shares in a company? And, you know, and there's, you know, our brains work a certain way. There's definitely hard science there to suggest that when things, you know, come for free too much and too often, our thinking does shift around them. And that kind of stuff just fascinates me. I'm always paying attention to it.
Well, and I wonder how much of it is inner too, because, I mean, and you go through this a lot in your book where you ask yourself in more or less, I'm probably paraphrasing, but you ask yourself, am I a real artist? Like you constantly mention the fraud police at every new level you get to in your career. You feel like the fraud police is going to pull you right back down. And I wonder, to some extent, a lot of asking is about the inner battle, you know, before you even ask, like where do you value yourself on that, on that hierarchy of art?
Right. That's like step one is if you're going to ask with grace, you really have to believe in the worthiness of what you're asking for, whether it's art or business or love or whatever. Because if you don't believe you really deserve this thing you're asking for, your ask isn't going to come across all that hot because anyone can see through you. Because you can't bullshit a bullshitter. And if you really don't believe what you're asking for, you're not going to get a really enthusiastic response from the person you're asking.
It's interesting because part of the connection between, let's say, art and asking is someone will usually ask something because they don't know what the real value is. So, like, let's say I want to perform a service and I'm afraid to ask for more money for that service because I don't really know how to value that service. And art is often in the same place where you don't really know how to value art. You kind of have to, you know, the value is some sort of combination between your own perception of your skills and society's perceptions of your skills. And I think kind of overcoming that is part of the issue with asking as well.
Yeah. And a lot of it is, as artists, a lot of it is overcoming the idea of solidity, like the idea that this canvas and paint is inherently worth $5,000, no ifs, ands, or buts. And instead, understanding that art is a conversation, that everything is fluid, that it's all kind of bullshit anyway, but we have to assign value to things if we are going to eat, communicate, pay our rent, and get on with making more art. And the artists I know who are good at it are just good at accepting the bizarreness and the fluidity of commerce and saying, like, well, yes, you know, I've got to slap a price on this. And I have to accept that my time and energy and skill and inspiration and blood, sweat, and tears are worth something. And yes, it may feel random, but I have to keep moving and I have to keep making art, so I'm not going to get hung up on the, you know, on the randomness and, you know, the seeming incongruousness of, you know, X equals dollar sign, because it just, it can drive a person crazy. Well, and it does. I mean, I do know artists driven crazy because valuing your work can be so difficult because, you know, art is simultaneously worthless, because it's not just a crate of grapefruit that you can track from point A to point B, but it's also priceless because it's this thing that infuses our life with meaning. And, you know, and since we're inherently artists, we should be able to be creative about this shit in the first place. So, you know, it's why I love talking with you about this now. Like, a big part of it is just accepting the fact that it's weird and talking about it openly and going, ha-ha! You know, yes, it's random that a song on iTunes is 99 cents. And, you know, let's just accept that that's random and move on from there.
Well, you know, it's funny. You mentioned people don't value stuff often that they get for free. And I tried this experiment once on a book I wrote. I said in the very front page, even before the title page, I want you to buy this book. But if you can prove to me that, but I know people don't value what they get for free. So if you can prove to me that you read the book and that you bought the book, then I will return your money if you want. And, but I need you to buy it first because otherwise you won't value it. And the experiment.
It's a book with a money back guarantee.
It was sort of like a money back guarantee. Yes. And, you know, only one half of 1% asked for their money back, but previously, I had just given books away for free, and I really felt like now, just with that one change, people really were valuing the book a lot higher because they had to pay for it.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, the science is in. That is a true fact, and I have found that to be true in my experiments with pay what you want, pull-down menus on my website as well. Generally, when you give option the people to pay what you want, they will usually choose zero. But if you make the barrier entry very, very low and you charge someone 5 cents, by the time they've input their credit card information, they're going to pay you a little bit more because they don't want to value your song at 5 cents.
Yeah, and I guess also there's this kind of sunk cost, you know, cognitive bias. Once they enter their credit card information, they relate that to all their other credit card transactions. Well, their brain starts thinking, well, I must have put my credit card in for a reason. And so their brain just tells them to give more money. But let me ask you this. So the fraud police was always trying to catch up to you in your claims to be an artist at every step of the way. Do you feel now you're an artist?
You know, I feel like Eminem. I am what you say I am. Like, I think a lot of people have called me an artist. So yes, I can take on that mantle.
But notice how you said that though. You still were dependent on everybody else, like kind of like everybody took a vote and said.
But you know, I think it's a little deeper than that, because I definitely feel like an artist, but I feel like an artist is a title that does come from the outside, because I've felt like an artist from the day I was born, just as much as I just feel like a human being. And call me crazy, but when I look out at the sea of humanity, I kind of think everybody's an artist. I really do. I think most people who don't call themselves artists just aren't recognizing the creative aspects of themselves that they could be or should be because they've been wiped. But pretty much everybody I know is a creative person and therefore an artist.
Do you think though some people let that creative side stagnate a little bit so they're not activating those muscles in their brain?
Totally. And I think it is a pox on culture that we box up artists so hardcore and that we favor our children, like, oh, you know, Susie's the artist and Johnny's the one who's good at math. And I mean, I really do think we fuck each other up by not recognizing the degree to which we are all really artistic. And you see that way more in this culture than you do in others.
You know, I want to just briefly close with one great example you have in your book, where the asking and the giving and what I call the outrage porn all intersected, which was when you...
I love the term outrage porn, by the way.
Yeah.
I'm going to start using that.
It's sort of like, you know, it kind of came to me because it's sort of like once a year I was experiencing it heavily myself, and you just have to label it because that's how I distance myself from it. Otherwise, yeah. I'll get dragged down by it. But there was this one example where... And I thought this was a great example where you invited local, wherever you were performing, you would send out the tweet or put it on your blog or whatever and say local artists can perform for free or come up on the stage with you or whatever. And then there was all this outrage that you weren't paying them, that somehow you were exploiting these people. And you made the point that you could have actually offered that as a reward on Kickstarter and people would have paid for it. And instead there was this outrage that you had to pay for them. So it's funny how like commerce and economics are totally warped depending on how you view it. And also just how crappy people are that you sometimes have to deal with.
Yeah, well, and more so, a couple of weeks ago, Jack Conti of the band Pomplamoose posted a Medium blog making all of his tour revenue transparent. And some of the same media outlets who criticized me a couple of years ago for that volunteer musician thing, you know, these same people who said, Amanda, you need to pay your volunteers. This is totally unethical. You're an asshole. Some of these same outlets turned around and said, you know, Jack, you're an idiot. Why are you paying your band before you net a profit? So it's really like there's just no pleasing everybody. And I just wrote an article about that in The Guardian, and I said, you know, as musicians who want to be transparent, we're just screwed the minute we open our mouths, because if we play by the rules, we're kind of punished. If we find a clever way of dancing around the rules and being creative, we're punished. I mean, there really is this kind of outrage anywhere you go.
But what's
and
the difference?
The only way out is through. I mean, you gotta just keep making your work and ignoring the haters. There's no other way around it.
But what's the difference between that and, let's say, Mick Jagger? So he's not totally transparent, but we roughly know the Rolling Stones makes like $200 million per tour. And he's a billionaire, and he has no problem asking for $150 for a ticket. Like, what separates him from the people who do have trouble asking?
The size of his penis? I'm not sure. I don't know. I mean, I think we have such a warped perception of value and who has the right to ask and doesn't have the right to ask. I think the important thing is there has to be a blanket acceptance. Mick Jagger has to, we have to feel just as much acceptance and compassion for him and the billionaires and the Rolling Stones as we do for the garage band down the street who are afraid to charge $5 for a ticket, because we're all technically in the same boat. And if you can't see us all as human beings and artists with our own sets of problems, whether it's Mick Jagger, the billionaire, or the guy in the garage band, or, you know, the girl in the folk club, you have to allow that we're all just trying to figure it out day to day, and that there's no one who's not allowed to ask for something, and there's no one who's allowed to ask for everything without, you know, with the assumption that they just can't be rejected. We're all human beings, and we're trying to connect with and help each other, and you cannot selectively criticize, make fun of, or outcast anyone because they have or haven't been successful. It's just not fair, and it's not good for the general ecosystem of art and musicianship. And if Mick Jagger wants to go out and charge $150 for a ticket, and someone out there feels like it's worth their $150 to buy that ticket, then you have to have respect for both people in that exchange. Yeah, and you have to have respect for every artist and every audience member who wants to get into a relationship with that artist. Even if the shit you think they're asking for is really weird, you've got to have a blanket respect.
Like, what's a weird thing to ask for? I just asked that because you
bring
mentioned...
Bring your own dildo. I really don't know. Good question. I think that's a good place to end.
Well, I'm going to end with a quote from the book. I'm going to end with a quote from the book where you say, you can fix almost anything by authentically communicating. And I think that's a good starting point for learning how to ask and getting over that vulnerability. And that's in your book. I highly recommend people get The Art of Asking so that I can easily back out of doing my book. And Amanda, I really appreciate you coming on the podcast. Good luck with everything. And thanks again.
Thank you for having me. It's been great to talk.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
For more from James, check out the James Altucher Show on the Stansberry Radio Network at stansberryradio.com and get yourself on the free insiders list today.
Ready for a new and exciting career challenge? At DHL Supply Chain, you're part of a team committed to creating innovative solutions for some of the biggest brands in the world. We're recognized as a best place to work, where people are valued, supported, and respected. DHL Supply Chain is hiring for a wide range of salaried operational and functional roles. Previous experience in logistics is welcome, but not required. All opportunities, no boundaries. DHL Supply Chain. Apply today at joindhl.com.